Hi friends, welcome back to Red Eyes Radio. This is Henrik Palmgren, and we are all about bringing attention to hidden knowledge, forgotten wisdom, and things that most people have no idea about. As always, we're very glad and fortunate to have you with us, listening and willing to learn something new. Today, we have an interesting program for you with Marty Lees, who discusses the seemingly overwhelming subject of mathematics, and how it unlocks an understanding of many other subjects that are to be found in his book, Pi, The Great Work. And this is what we're going to talk about today. He claims spiritual doctrines, mythology, and folk tales are encoded with mathematical knowledge. His book presents us with the idea that all of the math in the universe can be done using numbers 1 through 9. Stay with us for much more. Marty Leeds, it's good to talk to you. Welcome to the program, and thank you for taking the time talking with us here today, Marty.
Oh, thank you.
This is going to be a lot of fun. We like to do shows on math, geometry, even going into alchemy. Of course, there's a lot of topics here. I remember a program we did, a couple of years ago almost now, with Michael Schneider on some of the basics of the numbers, and I think that will probably might be the closest of where we're kind of dovetail here today, of course. But why don't you give us a little bit of the background in the beginning here? You of course written Pi, The Great Work, and you have an active YouTube channel with lots of good videos on it that we urge people to check out. We're going to give out the URL for that later. So tell us what's inspired you and what why did you write the book, Marty?
Well, Michael S. Schneider actually was a great start. His book, what is it, 1 through 10, The Creation of the Universe, is a fantastic book. I basically got into alchemy and numbers. Actually, it kind of got into me. I just kind of studied a lot of things throughout my life, really focused on nonfiction. Haven't really read a fictional book in a while. And so eventually that just let, you know, and I looked into psychology and philosophy and theology and mythology, and eventually it just led me to language and numbers. And I was always really intrigued by, well, the secrets, you know, the quote-unquote secret things of our culture and the cultures of the past, and well, Freemasonry and alchemy is kind of at the top of the echelon there. So, it drove me there, and that's where I've parked my car, if you will.
Sure is, and you've parked it well, as you say, as well.
So, thank you.
What is Pi, and why should we even care about this, Marty?
Pi was just the most elusive number in mathematics, and it's one of the most important numbers. And when I got into Pi, I was just intrigued by number one. It starts with a three. And a lot of the, you know, well, number one, you have like the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. And in Hinduism, you have Shiva, Brahman, and Vishnu. And this trinity just seems to be very important. And so it intrigued me that Pi starts with a three. And then it's this, you know, quote unquote, irrational, transcendental number that just goes on into infinity. And yet, it's all it is essentially a circle. And so this just really intrigued me. And then, you know, slowly I got into things like gematria and stuff like that. And I was just wondering, you know, is all this stuff tied together? You know, in the book I mentioned that so many people of the past say that numbers are it. You know, it's like Galileo says, it's, you know, mathematics is the language that God wrote the world in, essentially. And so, yeah, I was just drawn to Pi that way. I guess that's all I can really say about it.
No, it's really interesting. Well, what is it that we hear about the fact that we need to, you know, we're trying to crack Pi all the time? It's like it's a mystery that is elusive. We can't get to it. The more we try to figure out the numbers, I don't even know personally how many numbers they're up to now. Was it millions? Do you know?
I have no idea. Yeah, as soon as it gets past like a million, I'm like, okay, we've gone too far. So, yeah, and the idea of cracking Pi always intrigued me too, because how I came to understand it is that Pi is actually a representation of the creation of our universe, because the circle is one of the most, you know, holy revered symbols of all time, really. You know, so to me, it was like, it was almost like a riddle, and you're not supposed to crack pi, and what you're supposed to do is put it back together, is try to understand the number from the very beginning as 3.14, and then, you know, go on and try to understand the numbers as they relate to each other, as they unfold into infinity. And so heaven in sacred geometry was always known as a circle, as a three. And that immediately was like, oh, okay. Well, if the first thing in creation was, as, you know, like the alchemists know, as like a philosopher's egg, or you have the Hiranyarbha and the Rig Veda, which everything was encased in an egg, then the diameter is actually the cracking of that egg. It's the cracking of pi. And so the riddle to me was like, okay, well, don't crack pi. Try to put it back together. You know, so try to link yourself back to the birth of creation.
Interesting. So there's a lot of different, you know, aspects and the way you've approached the subject matter. Really interesting in the book, the way you kind of lay it out in different types of, you know, kind of mysteries that we know about. Things like, obviously, squaring, you know, the circle, trying to find the mysteries behind the number, the number. You know, why, I don't know, do you look through 1, 2, 10 as well, kind of like Schneider did in that sense? I think you have a little bit more kind of elusive mysteries, if you will, in there as well, like 666 and stuff. But do you cover from 1 to 10 the basics?
Yeah, the first like 39 pages, actually, which Christian equals 39 in the cipher that I'm sure we'll talk about here, but which is really interesting. I didn't know that when I wrote the book. But yeah, the first few pages actually go into pi, number one, what it is, the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter. And then I actually look at each of the numbers in the base 10 system, you know, and focus on the ennead, which is the 1 through 9, essentially. And the qualities of those numbers and the geometrics of those numbers. And, you know, as I understood it, that these, you know, 1 through 9 and a 0 basically give you the cosmic principles of the entire universe. And this really resonates with the Greeks and the Egyptians, because they both had the Ennead. And they also have, like, the Christian angelic hierarchy is 9 stages and 3 levels, you know. And then you look at the Great Pyramid at Chichen Itza, and that's a 9-level pyramid, you know. And so I just kept coming back to this fact that it's 9. And then 9 and a 0. And when you go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and you get to 10, all you've done is go back to 1 and add a 0. And what's really interesting is 1 is an odd number, and 2 is an even number, 3 is an odd, 4 is an even. Well, when you get to 9, right, the next number is 10. And so if you add 1 plus 0, well, 10 is an even number, but if you add the 1 plus 0, now 10 becomes an odd number. And so this odd-even, Shiva Shakti, Adam Eve kind of thing, goes throughout the rest of the number line into infinity. And so that was really intriguing to me that, you know, in every, beyond the Ennead of 9, you know, the principles of 9, there's an odd and even in each number. And I found that very alchemical, if you will.
Indeed, it's. I think we should talk a little bit about some of Mark Rodin's work. That's been a big influence on you. Is that correct?
Yeah, that was. You know, I had known about like decimal parity and Theosophical Addition, where it's basically you take like a number like 46, and you add 4 plus 6 equals 10, and then you add the 1 plus 0 equaling 1. You know, breaking it down to any number between 1 through 9. And so I'd known about this for a long time. I think I first heard about it in Helena Blavatsky's work. But I didn't know how you could actually use it. And then when I saw Marco Rodin's work, it was like, oh, okay, well, here's an enormous way you can use it. You know, it makes this perfect 64 doubling and halving circuit. And so, yeah, it was very influential. And the symbol itself, the fact that it looks like an infinity sign, and, you know, 64 is known as a number of infinity, it just really intrigued me. It also looks like angel's wings to me. That's the first thing I thought. So immediately that brought me right back to spirituality and religion, and the fact that he got this symbol through visions in meditation and through his adherence to the Baha'i faith. And so that was very intriguing to me as well.
It seems that we can pick a lot of symbols out of the patterns that arise in mathematics. So in a sense, we might look at the numbers just as numbers, but in a sense there is more there. We can begin to add visual aids, obviously, to understand the numbers, but also to give them, in a sense, almost more meaning. We have so many different things that arise from it, you know, as you mentioned just here with Rodin's kind of the symbol that comes out of the vortex based math that he talks about. We have the Möbius strip. You even have a section in the book where you detail the eye, the Egyptian eye of Horus, and I've always looked at that one, by the way, as well, and quite not understood what people kind of mean, how you can find or get the math out of a symbol like that. Is that something you could talk a little bit about?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first off, numbers are not only quantities, but qualities, and they also have geometric shapes. So when you look at, certain numbers coming together to create geometry, you're actually creating symbols and, archetypes and things like that. And these are languages. We don't understand that. Most people don't understand that these are languages. Symbols are languages. They speak to you subconsciously in a subtextual way. And numbers do the same thing. People are attached to numbers in a lot of ways, and we use numbers every single day, and a lot of times we don't even recognize it. So to me, when I started getting into numbers and started mirroring numbers and understanding their qualities and essences and all of that, it really started speaking to me on a level, and according to a lot of people, that mathematics is the language of God. Well, then it's like, okay, well, is God speaking to me then? I mean, that's good. And I got a very spiritual, if you will, aspect from it. So it's just gone on from there. It's almost like I learned two other languages, symbols and mathematics and geometry, if you will.
Well, I mean, a lot of people talk about that, and so I think it's a pretty good point. It's an interesting point about, where is God in all of this? We're in a sense, we end up here. We don't really know where we come from. Except if we look at the fact that we have the ability to examine these things. But as far as we know, when we come here, we don't know squat. We're just here we are, and what the hell is going on, kind of thing. But in a way, are you saying that God actually is speaking to us, but we're not paying close enough attention, basically?
I guess I can say this is ultimately the conclusion that I've come to with a lot of trepidation, mind you, is that we are God. We are God looking at itself, that we are an undivided section of the whole thing. And unity has been such a prominent idea and concept, and it is the circle as well. I mean, a circle encapsulates the most amount of space with the least amount of effort. And so this idea of unity and monotheism, the reason it's monotheism is because there is a wholeness, a one, Well, even the Eye of Horus, as you just mentioned, is called the Wedget, and that means whole one. And so what Alan Watts has this great quote where he says, the further and further we look out with our telescopes and further we look in with our microscopes, the larger and larger and smaller the universe has to become in order to escape the investigation, because we are the universe looking at itself. We are God looking at itself. And I think this is, as far as I can tell, the secret teachings of all ages. It's what the mystics and magis and people that sought enlightenment in the past finally came to. And this is all over, like the Corpus Hermeticum and, the book The Holy Science, and a lot of these things, be as Christ, if you will.
So why do you think there is that so many mathematicians miss this? Or maybe they don't all do. It might just be that they don't talk about it, and certain people certainly stumble into it. But what is the component, do you think, that makes, your work different in that way, that you take it a step further than most people who work with numbers actually do? What is that little extra bit, if you will?
Well, going back to Marco's work, this idea of theosophical addition or Pythagorean addition, it's called a bunch of different things, digital root, it's not accepted by modern mathematicians at all. In fact, when I first came across Marco's work, I spent literally 3 weeks to a month figuring out if the guy was full of crap.
Yeah.
So I sent it to some of the mathematicians in Eugene, actually. So I was like, hey, what do you guys think of this? Some of the professors. And they basically wrote me back saying that, well, it uses numerology, so it's defunct. It doesn't mean anything, And I was just almost like flabbergasted by this, because I'm not a mathematician. I really even don't think I am a mathematician anymore, a math magician maybe. But So this really, it just dumbfounded me. I was like, well, how can something so simple and beautiful not be correct? You know, because at the heart, nature is simple and beautiful. Nature's going to find the simplest and easiest way to do something, you know. When you look at all of the theories that permeate our math, they're all simple. A squared plus B squared equals C squared equals MC squared. You know, the equation for fractals is essentially Z equals Z squared plus C. You know, the Fibonacci sequence is just adding the number previous to the number you added. You know, 0 plus 1 equals 1, 1 plus 1 equals 2, 2 plus 1 equals... This is all simple stuff. And so I see mathematics as very complicated, and most people do. It's very, and we're taught that it's very complicated, you know, that it's very cold and dry and it doesn't have any relationship to our life. And so that was the first thing that caught me, was that, okay, Pythagorean addition or Theosophical addition is legitimate, absolutely legitimate. And all of these mystics used it before. So that was, you know, that was the one thing that really caught my eye. And the other thing is that you constantly have this idea of everything in nature is mirrored. You know, in the principle of mechanics, it's called the principle of parity, I believe. And, what you have in the scripture of as above, so below, on earth as it is in heaven.
Right.
Earth is a reflection of heaven, and heaven is a reflection of earth. You know, and then you can see this everywhere. You can't, anything that you look at has this duality to it. You can look at the human body or a leaf or a bug or, you know, the earth itself as a northern hemisphere and a southern hemisphere. So this idea of duality is in everything. You know, tonight it is going to be night and tomorrow it's going to be day. And that's just the way it is, you know. So I started looking at numbers as in like, okay, the number 32 is also in one way the number 23. So, you know, I just mirrored that number and then started looking at things like that. And then I actually did this with a number line and I just kept going with it. And to me, it seems very legitimate, almost as if there in every matter there is a spirit. So maybe the matter, the number is 32, but the spirit is 23, if you get what I'm saying.
So what you're saying is that there is a relationship between all the numbers as well. You can't just... once you look at one number set, if you will, this is going to have a reflection in some way into other numbers.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I think the numbers work off each other in magical ways. I mean, I don't have any other word for it, you know. And I think Marco's work shows that. And, you know, there's definitely other things that I put in the book that I think show that as well.
For sure. For sure. There's so much to this subject, of course. Why don't we talk a little bit about the language aspect, which is very... very, very interesting. It goes into gematria, of course, and you've even you made a couple of videos about this specifically. I looked through the English alphabet video. Very, very interesting. Tell us a little bit about this and break it down for someone who are not familiar with this particular approach, Marty.
Well, when I started getting into gematria, whatever, however you say it, ultimately, I was like intrigued. I was like, okay, well, the Hebrews and the Kabbalah, this is the way it was done. Gematria was how they understood this, and so I was just on math. I was like, I wonder if there's one for the English alphabet, you know. And so I worked on this and worked on it, and you know, finally I came across basically several things that really helped me, and that was like the Jewish menorah. The tetragrammaton, which is basically symbol pi 7, pi 7, and then I used the Freemasonic symbol of the compass and the square and the G. And so I was like, okay, well, how do I put numbers to these letters? There's 26 letters, you know? And so immediately it was like, okay, well, there has to be a left and a right. There has to be a Shiva and a Shakti, or a Adam and Eve, if you will, black and white. And so I basically just separated the alphabet, you know, A through M and M through Z. And then I just used mythological motifs, basically these 7 days of creation. 6 days where God did work, and then the seventh day where he rested. So, so you can take A through M, and then N through Z, and then you can walk up, you know, A is 1, B is 2. Walk up to G is 7, and that's where, you know, the Sabbath. And then you can just walk back down to 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, ending on M. And then since you have 13 letters and 13 letters, you can do the same with, you know, the other side of the alphabet, N through Z. And there's, I don't have it with me, but there's a line that Albert Pike says in Secret Teachings of All Ages where he's talking about the Kabbalah and how it's just so simple and profound, and that it's, you know, it's got theorems more spectacular than Pythagoras and all of these things. And the one thing that really caught me is that it could be done on the human hands. And so immediately I was like, all right, well, if it can be, if that can be done in the human hands, then the English alphabet has to as well. And so I just laid my hands out and I said, A is my thumb and Z is my other thumb. And then, you know, you have 12 sections of your four fingers being, you know, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, and then N through Z on your right hand. And then you can actually underline the prime numbers, which are 2, 3, 5, 7, and then 5, 3, 2, and that adds up to 27. Well, there's 27 bones in a human hand. So A through M is 27 prime numbers and 27 bones in the human hand, and then N through Z is 27, and then, you know, just a, it's a mirror. You know, so here once again you have the duality. And so this was very profound to me. And then further, you know, you can add the non-prime numbers, which leaves you 146 and 641 on your left hand, and then the same on your right hand. And 6 plus 6 is 12, 4 plus 4 is 8, and 1 plus 1 is 2, and 12 plus 8 plus 2 is 22, and this leads you right to the G and the 7. So 22 divided by 7 is pi. So you have pi in your left hand and pi in your right hand, and that comes together to give you the tetragrammaton, or pi 7, pi 7. Pi begotten by 7 and pi begotten by 7. It's the holy name of God. And I found this extremely intriguing. And so I just started working with these numbers, and now I'm writing another book. So.
Well, there you go. Wow. This is the book you have out now, Pi, the Great Works. It's about, you know, 100 pages, really condensed with a lot of stuff, excellent graphics, obviously, to go along with this as we're talking about this, because it's somewhat difficult maybe to convey some of the ideas without imagery with this, but you're doing a great job. And the question that we always kind of come to, I guess, in a sense, when we talk about these things is the awareness involved when man is creating these things, what level that is. I mean, at some point or another, the English, for instance, the alphabet has been made or created or composed, at least put together by, you know, some people speculate that, you know, people like Francis Bacon was involved in this. There's other people. It certainly has been around, you know, longer than that. But there is a, when people come together and do these things, what do you think at this point the level of awareness is within that? Do they know what they're doing? Do they base their creations, so to speak, on these ratios, on these numbers, on these rules and laws, in a sense, that you're talking about?
Yeah, ultimately, I don't have an answer for that, because, like, I've started researching, like, where did this stuff come from, you know? Where did Gematria come from? Where did languages come from? I mean, as of right now, I think there's, like, 6,000 languages that are spoken on the planet, you know? And right. So where do these things come from, and why so many different languages? And really, you can't trace back to any one particular culture that, you know, created the language and assuredly did it. You know, it's, it was almost like it's evolved just like everything else, you know. And so, yeah, I guess I just don't have an answer for that. I mean, if somebody did create it, damn, were they smart, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they really knew geometry, they really knew symbol, they really knew the mathematics, you know. And to me, if they did create it, then they were the gods on earth, you know.
I mean, there seems to be kind of a primordial language. Some people have been trying to trace this. I mean, it almost like it's go back to some kind of you know, proto-Phoenician type, you know, Indo-European type of language. That seems to have spread, you know, to all the corners of the world, and then we see different variations of this, because in one sense or another, majority of the languages anyway are related in some sense. We have weird things like the, for instance, you know, the Rongo script coming, you know, out from Easter Island that has, seems to have in the symbolism of the language itself, the shapes of each letter, has clues about, you know, some people have attracted to even like, you know, plasma type events in the heavens, that these are, there are clues in there, which is just amazing. If that's true, that means that it actually has a reflection in, you know, the letters themselves has a reflection in the nature, something that was visible and observable. Have you heard about that, Marty?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't heard about that particular one, but, you know, definitely looking into this, it seems like there is a base of all languages, you know, that there's certain sounds like ah and ooh, and I mean, even when you speak, you know, what's the, when, you know, when we're trying to think of what we want to say and we're like, right? Well, A-U-M is right? You know, and it starts with an A as in an alpha, you know. So I think that certain sounds and vibrations actually have, and we know this from somatics, that they actually have geometric qualities and therefore have numbers that we can assign them to. So when languages are evolved or born or, you know, however they come to fruition, it's almost like they're following a fundamental pattern. And I equate this to, well, something as simple as the Fibonacci sequence, you know. The same sequence that's in a flower is in your body, and it's in every living thing. So why, maybe language has the same thing, you know. There's many different flowers, and they all, but they all grow from a different sequence. Now there's trilliums, and there's lilies, and there's orchids, and there's roses, you know. But they all speak the same language, if you will, you know, if you know what I'm saying. Mm. And I also see that, you know, this idea of the rose cross, you know, the rose on the center of the cross, as that's what it resonated with me. That's what it was kind of telling me. The language actually is the flower. It's the flowering of speech, you know.
So how much do you think that the esoteric, you know, branches of the secret societies have in all this? If we look at the Freemasonic tradition, many people, you know, say that it actually traces back to an earlier tradition, which is in, you know, majority at least today kind of has been lost. I mean, we have Masonic scholars that are out and trying to find the roots and origins of their own traditions that they adhere to, which is kind of strange in a sense. But the Rosicrucians, then, for instance, there too, we have the Rose Cross. What do they know? Do they know all of this stuff that you're talking about, do you think?
That's an excellent question. You know, I'm getting into Freemasonry quite a bit. I've always had an interest in it, especially in the last couple of years. And, you know, I've actually spoken to a few Freemasons. And as far as I know, I mean, I don't know what level they are or what degree they are, but a lot of these people don't know this, you know, or don't even understand what this, you know, square in the circle means. And that's like their insignia. That is their main symbol.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's lost, or, you know, if the people in the upper echelon know it and they use it to their advantage. I don't really see Freemasonry as like an evil institution. I believe it's an institution, and any institution can become corrupted, whether it's political, you know, religious, whatever it is. So, yeah, I mean, the one thing that really gets me is that it's stuck around, you know, and it seems to have all these roots in, as far as I can tell, alchemy and, you know, Egypt, especially. And so maybe it's, stuck around because it's numbers, you know. It's numbers, language, geometry, sound, all rolled into one, and it has to stick around, you know. I guess I don't really have a good answer as far as, like, you know, how did they lose it? And if it's so important, you know, where did it go? And, I mean, Yeah, I guess I can't answer that just yet. Hopefully, I'll be able to someday.
we're going to continue looking for those kinds of answers. It's fascinating. It's always been an interesting, you know, subject to me in that sense, that we have the echoes of the of some kind of earlier tradition, in a sense. It feels like, and for some reason, it's been lost, and it's kind of been waxing and waning almost, in a sense, throughout history as well. It comes and goes. It gets, you know, stronger in a sense in certain periods, and then it kind of dies down a bit. We have a renaissance, and then it, you know, dies down a bit. And this seems to, you know, go back to the Hermetic tradition that you mentioned earlier as well, that this is something that is contained within there, and people can understand parts of the wisdom, perhaps, but even those small little tiny parts help incredibly to advance humanity to a new level of understanding. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, and, I mean, the Rosicrucians, speaking of, they said that they go through a period of activity and inactivity, and this is a period of 108 years, which I found really interesting. And if you just look at nature herself, you know, she ebbs and flows, you know, high tides, low tides, you know. You know, in the Bible it says, to everything turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, 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 you know. And what's it saying is that consciousness and our understanding of these things has a winter and it has a summer. And, you know, our great fear, as, you know, Walter Cruttendon, his, you know, postulizes that the consciousness is intimately linked to this. So there is a point, there's a golden age, and then there is a dark age. And currently, I think we might be in the dark age. I think we're coming out of it. You and I are part of that. You know, I don't, you know, I think that we're helping bring it on, but I think that we're just part of the flow of the whole thing, you know. People have mentioned, how are you coming up with this? And, you know, this is great work, you know, this sort of thing. And I really don't even feel like I'm doing it, you know. When I did the video for the chess thing, I sat back and I was just like, oh, wait. Chess encodes pi and a lunar and solar processional calendar. I was really just bereft. I was like, I don't even really feel like I'm doing this, you know. And the only way I can really understand that is being a songwriter. And after doing this for years and years and years, it's like you get this spark. You get this ounce of creativity that comes in. It's like the angel comes in, or the muse, or the helping hand, or the, you know, Anthropos or Damon, whatever it is, comes in and it gives you a line, gives you a riff, gives you a melody, an idea. And to me, it's almost like that idea is an entire song in and of itself, you know. And so it's just giving you, it's basically like, here's a stone. And beneath this stone is David, but you have to whittle away. You're not really doing it, you know. It's actually underneath there, and all you have to do is chip at it. It's always been there, you know. So, and actually Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, has a great TED Talks about this, about how she was releasing released Eat, Pray, Love, and it was this monumental success, and then she had to release her follow-up to it, and she was, you know, psychologically scared, and so she went back to the Greeks, and they had the daemons, you know, and so the daemons were, you know, it was the idea of not being a genius, but having a genius, you know, and I really resonate with this, because after years of, like I said, songwriting, it's like, I don't really feel like, if I write a decent song, it's almost like, how did I even do that, you know? Well, where did that come from? How can I just spew out, you know, a list full of lyrics in, you know, 15 minutes? You
that's
know?
Right.
And you know, and so, I don't, yeah, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, I was just going to ask you then, so where do you think it comes, well, you mentioned the muse, obviously, that we have something coming into it, but that puts us in a different role, where we are merely kind of the conduits of something that is going to come out, in a sense. And it's almost more up to if we're open, or if you will, willing, or, you know, in a position where we can enable this flow to come out through. And some people seem to be able to tap into that more. So they are like just, in a sense, willingly tapping into something, the force, the creativity out there. And then they just manage to, you know, to receive those initial sparks that you mentioned and do something on it. Do you think there is some level of, I don't know, maybe not tweaking, but there must be some level of harnessing these ideas and kind of just learning to maybe work with them in a specific way as well, to be, well, maybe not to be successful, but to present and get out those ideas in a powerful way. What do you think?
I think it's all about the work, you know. I mean, this is why I think it's called like the labor of the Lord, or the great work, the magnum opus, you know. It's choosing to do the work and letting it come out, you know. And I think this might be where having faith comes in a way, you know. Going back to, you know, duality and, you know, this sort of thing, I've heard so many people talk about daemons and how they're evil or how they're really good, or, you know, it's always one or the other. They're coming and they're trying to, you know, steer humanity in the wrong way. Well, I, you know, in the experiential world, you always have this duality. So it's no coincidence that, you know, daemon and demon are so close,
right,
in the language, linguistically. And so really it's you choosing how to see it. Is it the devil on your left shoulder, or is it the angel on your right? You know, the same, you know, I call spirit the serpent, because that's how that, you know, basically that's what the mythologies told me to tell, you know, to say it. And the spirit is, the serpent is, it's the height, how best to say it? It's your worst nightmare and your finest hour.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you can get, you know, I'm a musician, so you can get on stage and you can be like, I'm just going to get in tune with the crowd, and I'm going to get up there and I'm going to be, you know, no ego, and I'm just going to present my all and give it my hardest and play to my heart. Or you can get on stage and be like, I'm better than everybody else. Look at me, I got a guitar. You know what I mean?
Right, right.
And then you can fail horribly. You know, and so I think, and why is, you know, the serpent is the spear is because it's slippery. It's slippery as all hell, you know, it can get away from you. And I think the idea of doing the great work, or, you know, the alchemical work, is to get up every day, grab this serpent by its neck, look it dead in its eyes, take your sword and put it right in its head and say, I own you, you don't own me, and I have to work to keep you, you know, hold of you.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I think that mythologizing this stuff is so awesome. You know, like,
right.
You don't even have to believe in like any god or anything like that to be like, man, you know, World of Warcraft is awesome. You know, you know, that sort of thing. People can get into these things. You know, princesses and dragons, and demons and angels and stuff like that. And they, you know, they could be atheists, but for some reason, it really resonates with them.
Yeah, it attracts so many people from all walks of life. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So in a sense, it's like exactly, it can be a very, in that sense, an evil force to you personally. It can be a very detrimental to you if you don't know how to handle it right, or if you don't in a sense also maybe have, I don't know, respect for it, but at the same time you need to have no fear. You need to be bold and actually dare to do it, because it's only then when you actually can begin to do some of the great work, in a sense. So it's, what's happening here, in a sense, Marty, is this is reflected within us. We pick and choose sides of this all the time, in a sense. We are, no matter how much we want to or not, we are stuck in that duality. We have that reflected within us as a pattern all the time. We have the black and the white. We have good and evil in us, and we're constantly going back and forth and trying to kind of, you know, find our way in this, find the balance between these you know, components or properties of nature, and then in the process try to do something great out of it. Because some people would say here, as they listen to this, these are, you know, evil, esoteric, satanic even traditions that we should stay far, far away from, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think this harkens to the alchemical marriage or the alchemical wedding, you know, that there's a duality inside you, and the only way to understand everything is to unify them, you know. And I understood this as like Jungian psychology really, really pointed me to this, because there's an idea that's called the anima and the animus. And it's basically like, and every man is a woman and every woman is a man. You know, and so then it's identifying as a man, identifying with your female side, you know, identifying with that, you know, the more poetic, if you will, side. And I think this is what the alchemists were talking about. And so I actually look, okay, well, where do you find this, you know? Well, you can find it in Leonardo da Vinci's The Mona Lisa, you know. He actually modeled that painting after himself, after the features of himself, you know. Well, why would he do that, you know? And why is this painting so famous? You know, how it's super small, number one. It's like, what are the dimensions? You know, nothing by nothing. It's super tiny, you know? Mm. And she's got this little smirk, and she's looking at you, you know? And so that's Leonardo da Vinci looking at you as his female self, and this is what it said to me. And what's interesting is that I did the numerical equivalent for Mona Lisa. Number one, it's called Mona. And Mona is a reference to the monad, the Greek monad, which is the same as the Egyptian sun glyph. It's just literally, you take a compass, you pierce a page, you make a point, and then you make a circle. And this is the same glyph in Egypt and Greece.
And, mm-hmm. And it is not related to the moon, though, because of the word.
Well, I think, you know, it might be as well. But the thing that told me was, okay, mm-hmm. So the interior female of Leonardo da Vinci was Mona Lisa, okay? So then I did the numerical equivalent of Mona Lisa, and it adds up to 19. Well, the monad in the Greek gematria added up to 361, and the square root of 361 is 19. Hmm. And so I was really captivated by that. And I think it's a truism that our culture just doesn't want to accept. You know, I live in southern Wisconsin, and if you went and had a beer at, you know, the bar and told some guy there, was like, hey, you got a woman inside you, he'd be like, what are you talking about, bro? You know, I mean, you know,
right.
Like, Right. It would just be like, you're crazy, you know? And so I took this, and in the book, I took it very poetically. I called my female self Claudia Pavonis. And so any poetic line that I put in there was under her name, so.
Interesting. Do you think that there is a, and this seems to be true in you know, if we look at scripture as well, there seems to be an interesting schism or problem that arises when people also make literal interpretations of esoteric traditions. You know, this could be echoed, for instance, in the sense of the androgynous is hermaphrodite. This is like to show that this is going back to Hermes and Aphrodite, the Hermaphrodite. This is the combination of the two, right? But in a sense, some people make literal interpretation of this. We have an interesting, transhuman movement that seems to be moving towards the androgynous ideal, for instance. And that, to me, anyway, seems like a very, very literal interpretation. It's like what you said, you know, this is components that are within you that you need to recognize. It doesn't matter if you try to externally make yourself into both. What do you think, Marty?
I think it goes back to the whole idea that we are God looking at itself. You know, this idea of the virgin birth, you know, like the Virgin Mary. Well, virgin originally mean unmarried, you know, so the unmarried married, you know. So it's just like combining the two. And the first, why we have this duality in us is because the first thing was androgynous. The first thing was neither man nor female. And this first thing cracked, you know, if you will, and created the two sides, created the Garden of Eden, you know, or when Adam and Eve were casted out of the Garden of Eden, you know. And so this is why I think that this psychological idea is so resonant in me, and I think a lot of people in the past. You know, and exactly, I mean, Hermes, I mean, that tells you right there, he was a hermaphrodite, yeah. You know. So what more can you say? He obviously had a female aspect inside him. And I, just like I said, I think psychologically this does wonders for oneself. I mean, it's done wonders for me, you know. It may not make me popular at that bar that I was talking about, but...
Well, maybe that's not the most important thing in the world either. So,
yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? Yeah.
Well, it's about your own, you know, working on yourself in that sense, where you want to head, where you want to go, what do you want to do in your life in a sense, and how much of it do you want to understand? Because this is one idea that came to me earlier, or as you were talking about this, that the fact that, you know, someone like you and me who have, you know, at least a basic understanding of these things can see these patterns in the reality around me, in even some things that man makes, but primarily actually in nature, the patterns that is in how a tree grows or, you know, different, you know, ratios that is simply there. But most people, if we just go back to that for a second, still does not recognize that they are truly living in a bubble, totally, you know, cornered off from the rest of reality in a sense. So why is that? Do you think that if we have these patterns within us, why don't most people see it or recognize it, and the fact that we miss it while other people just are on it right away? What do you think?
Well, I'm still trying to get it, you know. I don't really feel like I have it or anything like that, that's for sure, you know. I mean, I think everybody has their own path that they take in their life. Number one, I think that this knowledge has been lost, whether it's because we're on a low tide of nature or, you know, I think there's a Buddhist idea or Hindu idea, I'm not sure which one it is, but that God plays hide and seek with himself, that he loses himself and then he finds himself, you know, and this really resonates with the whole, you know, golden age, dark age kind of thing. Well, for instance, when I was getting into sacred geometry and stuff like that, and I was like, wow, sacred number. I remember I had this friend, I was reading the Quadrivium, and he's like, does that say sacred number? Like, are you kidding me? You know? And it's, I mean, so many people do not even know about certain things like this, but actually doing geometry can help you understand, as far as I see or am concerned, creation, you know? And even myself, when I came across the Tetractus, I was like, there's a prayer to the Tetractus. I was like, what? Your prayer? You're having a prayer to a mathematical idea? That seems ludicrous to me. But now it seems absolutely perfect in a way. It seems completely legitimate. So we've lost a lot of this knowledge. And the fact that, our churches are teaching the fact that this is, the Bible is a literal document. And to me, the people that wrote the Bible wrote it in such a way that we would never think this, I really like the comedian Joe Rogan, not that I always agree with him or anything, but he has this great bit about Noah's Ark, and he says, I don't want to be offensive here because I'm just quoting a comedian, but he says, if you told the story of Noah's Ark to an 8-year-old retarded boy, he's going to have some questions, God commanded Noah to build an ark and, got all the animals 2 by 2 to come from around the world. He sailed 40 days and 40 nights until civilization began anew. And the punchline is that, an 8-year-old retarded boy is going to have some questions. Such a mythological idea that to literally believe it seems ludicrous to me, But at the same time, now that I've come to understand more mythologies, I think that they're more important than history itself, because we don't even know what has actually happened in history. People say, the Romans did this or the Chaldeans did this, and just because somebody wrote something down doesn't necessarily mean that
it's
true.
Absolutely right. Absolutely.
I mean, just look at how 9/11 is going to go down in history. I read the 9/11 Commission report and it's a pile of shit, but and so what's going to happen 100 years? Is that going to be the historical document? So when you actually look throughout history, you can't say that this is exactly what happened, but this is exactly what happened. But what you can do is look at all the mythologies and understand that there is a thing called enlightenment, and there is a path that you can take. It's called the way. It's called, the magnum opus. It's called the labor of the Lord, the alchemical dream, whatever you want to call it. But this is a very true thing. And, I mean, just look at the characters of, Orpheus, Dionysus, Jesus, Horus, Atlas, Ophiuchus. What do all these things have in common? Us, And then I think this is what they were saying, And the fact that the you and us, this us, is probably a numerical vibration that is actually signifying all of humanity.
What we're doing today, Marty, is obviously we're the majority, in a way, if we generalize here, are going the literal way. We are collecting data, in that sense, more and more about every single little event. And, of course, the truth of those events can and should be argued, of course. It's a kind of a mistake, as you say, to walk this path, I think, because we're not – this could be lost, first of all. Incredibly quick, overnight, if something happens. Today, even more so, because, in the past, things burned down and it was all lost. In other cases, it could be a data loss today. We could have a big CME smack our computers, and that's it. We lose everything. Yeah. But a story, if we have a small story that is orally, transmitted or conveyed throughout the centuries, we're still going to have the basics of that. Why do you say that a story is more powerful in that sense than piles and piles of data or history? It encapsulates quite a bit. That's what you're saying, right?
Yeah, because of just like what you just said, that the whole thing could fall. The Library of Alexandria burned twice. How much information was lost there, but we still have the story of Isis and Osiris,
Yeah.
And what does that story mean to us, If all the Bibles of the world burned, we would still have the story of Jesus on the cross. And if we look at the symbolic, metaphorical, linguistic, numerical ideas of this story, and we really, really penetrate it, then I think that we'll understand, I think this is why these stories have lasted.
Absolutely. I think so, too. There's a powerful message in them. And again, I think we all we resonate with them for different reasons, and I've always been intrigued with Greek mythology and other kinds of mythology from all over the world, and there are so many fascinating stories out there that I think can teach us things that they tell us, they can teach us about our own life, the challenges that we will we're going to face throughout our lives as well. It's just amazing when you think about it. And in the next hour, Marty, I want to dive into some of the more details about things like chess that you mentioned briefly. I want to talk a bit more about that because that's fascinating. I want to talk about squaring the circle as well, some of the other things that you have contained in your book. But let's spend a little time plugging it, if you will, as well, because it's available. It's called Pi, The Great Work. It's available on, I guess, Amazon.com would be the best place to go. Is that correct, Marty?
Yes, yeah, that's the best place, yeah.
Absolutely. And then, yeah, go ahead.
I just thought of something that I came to like about 3-4 days ago, and we were just talking the last thing about Greek civilization, you know, and one thing I came to was the idea of Apollo was the hero at Delphi, you know, he was the guy that slayed the serpent dragon Typhon or whatever, right? And so I was like thinking about our language, and I was like, I apologize, you know, we'll break that down, you know, what is jais? Jais is a lot like guys or a veil or a mask. You know, and Apollo is, of course, the hero there. So what are you saying when you say, I apologize? You're saying, I screwed up. I made a mistake. I was judgmental against you. You know, I did something that I shouldn't have done. But I am not that person. I am really Apollo in disguise. That's what you're saying, you know. Things like that, and I think it's embedded in our language. And the fact that there's numerical equivalents to it, I think, can point to a lot of different things. For instance, and then you say this real quick, Sphinx equals 24, Bishop equals 24, Egypt equals 24, Earth equals 24, Israel equals 24. You know, how many hours in a day are on Earth? You know, 24, you know. Israel is heaven on Earth, you know. Egypt was heaven on Earth, you know. So, yeah.
Very interesting. There's so much to it, of course, and we've just begun to scrape the surface and the roots of it, the intentions of it, and how these traditions are passed down to us, in a sense, also something I want to try to get a little bit closer at, in a sense, because we have the traditions coming through, but we're not getting it in a sense either. And I think some of your work here is about opening up a little bit of that. Some people might argue too, of course, that this is whatever, you know, you can find anything in numbers. I've heard that so many times. I want to get your take on that too, Marty. What do you think about that? And personally, I believe that's true, though, because you can and will and should find everything in the numbers, because it might indeed be number-driven, as you mentioned in the beginning. What is the main website you give out here as well, Marty? Is it your YouTube channel?
Yeah, right now I have a website that I'm working on. It's just not going to be up for a little while, just because I'm kind of busy right now. But I'm definitely working on another book right now, and it's going really well. And yeah, I do have a book available on CreateSpace and Amazon.com. But yeah, and I will be posting more videos, but you can just visit my YouTube channel, MartyLeeds33.
Excellent. YouTube.com/MartyLeeds33. MartyLeeds33, that's the channel. We're going to link that up as well. And we're going to have links to the book as well, so in case you're interested, in case you want to see more practical of the, you know, some of the examples here that we talked about, pick up a copy of the book. You won't be disappointed, I think, because it's a lot of fascinating, you know, information in there. You've done a really good job condensing all of this, condensing some of the more difficult ideas, and then I urge people to go and check out some of the videos there as well. Excellent, you know, aid to present some of the things that are already in the book as well, Marty. So great work on that. Stay with us, and we'll continue with more after this break. the second hour, we explore what would change if people truly understood the sacred aspects of math, mythology, and esoteric teachings. Marty says that everything in math points us to love. We have an unconscious knowledge of numbers and our connection to them. Then we'll talk about the esoteric side of squaring the circle, 666, the number 64, and more. Leeds tells us about the symbolism found in the game of chess. Marty also mentions the connection between synchronicity and numbers. We'll talk about how numbers speak to us and why. Later, we talk about the holographic universe made up of a matrix of numbers. Marty discusses free will as choices within a perimeter. And Leeds ends the hour sharing a vision he had of the electric serpent. To listen to the next hour, subscribe for a membership with Red Ice Creations. All the information is available on the website redicecreations.com. Much more is coming up in the next hour that you shouldn't miss. With a membership, you'll also get full access to all of our archives, tons of material for you to study, learn, and get excited about, things that you can share with your friends, your family. And I think one of the most important things that we can do right now is to learn as much as we can to become wiser and to attain true understanding and wisdom. Next up on Red Ice Radio, we have Sterling Allen for a free energy news update. Some exciting developments on this front. After this, we have Kristi Johansson joining us to talk about the horrible story of the kidnapping of his son Dominic by the Swedish state. Then we have Louis Turi, Matt Stein, Stefan Molyneux, Desiree and JJ Hertak, William Davis, Mark Weber, Mary Sean Young, Kurt Lindahl, Tom Horn, Jay Widener, Dean Clifford, and Jordan Maxwell, to name a few. But stay with us now as we continue to discuss Pi, the great work with Marty Leeds, coming right up after this break.